Andre Carson calls elements of the Tea Party racist. Is he right? Steve Goldsmith arrested for domestic violence. Rupert for governor and the state plan for payments to state fair victims. That, plus an Indianapolis landmark imploded and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 2, 2011. Ice
Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. The path to a successful business has unexpected twists and turns. The legal professionals at Ice Miller are dedicated to guiding businesses along the journey. Experience takes businesses to the top. Ice Miller can help them stay there. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.
This week, Indiana Congressman Andre Carson made national headlines with explosive remarks made in Miami. He called elements of the Tea Party racist in a speech made at a Congressional Black Caucus town hall meeting. This is a YouTube video of what he said.
This is the effort that we're seeing of Jim Crow. Some of these folks in Congress right now would love to see us as second-class citizens. Some of them in Congress right now with this Tea Party movement would love to see you and me, I'm sorry, Chairman, hanging on a tree.
He's either ignorant of the Tea Party, or he's like his party nationally finding a scapegoat for the problems of this country.
You know, out on a limb or hanging on a tree. To me, our people are out on a limb. They're out on a limb, Jim.
Should Andre Carson apologize for those remarks? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanes, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV Statehouse reporter Jim Shellum. Mike McDaniel, were those comments inappropriate?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's incredibly reckless for a sitting member of the United States Congress to say that about other members of the United States Congress, which is the context in which you said it. And because of that, I don't see how that can go unpunished and shouldn't go unpunished in Congress itself. But worse than that, I think he's damaged his own reputation. He's probably hurt his effectiveness to represent the people of Indianapolis. And politically, he becomes a liability for some people in his own party, including, you know, candidates for mayor, future candidates for governor, who probably won't want to put their arm around a guy that makes those kind of racist comments. So it's going to hurt him, and it's going to take a while for him to get over this kind of damage if he recovers from it.
A couple of things. First of all, there is some racism in elements of the Tea Party. I think you can prove fairly easily. Just look at the reaction to right. What he said. But there is a real problem when he attributes this to members of Congress who are a part of the Tea Party, isn't
well,
it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, certainly it might present. I'm sure that if he had to do it over, there'd be slightly different words he'd use. But when you look at the objective studies done by a professor from Notre Dame who looks at the Tea Party in depth and determines that, first of all, they're not some group that haven't been involved before. They're activists, engaged Republicans, number one. And number two, on top of that, there are, as we all know, some nasty elements in this country that don't represent this country's values, and they're disproportionately represented in the Tea Party. And when you look at what he went through with the health care debate last year, with the threats on his life and the racist comments that he overheard, it's not surprising that as a black member of Congress he'd feel that way. And I do think there are elements of racism in the Tea Party.
Do you sanction what he said?
I said that he should have used different words for it, but I don't think, but I think that the having a debate on whether or not there are tendencies towards racism in the Tea Party is a debate worth having, Michael.
Outrageous.
Well, there are tendencies in a lot of groups. I guess
absolutely.
I think one of the questions that needs to be asked at the moment is, should a congressman try to elevate the debate?
Sure. I think that that's a given. I think that a congressperson should hold him or herself to a higher standard. There's no question about it. I think Ann's right. I think Congressman Carson probably should have chosen different words and certainly different imagery to convey what I'm sure he believes is an assault, a racist assault on their positions. Look, the coarse nature of this discussion is elevating daily, and it's very worrisome. I don't think we're headed in a good direction when we have a situation like this. I think we've got the problem on both sides of the aisle. We're a factionalized nation, and it's going to lead ultimately probably to violence, and I don't like that direction that we're going, because we keep going in that direction. That goes right back to your point, Jim, and I think that it's very dangerous, really.
I mean, based on the press reports later in the week, he himself, Andre Carson, said he wished he had used different language and suggested perhaps that the description that he used was not the best, but he didn't back away from the thrust of the comment. So we get down to your question, Jim, about, you know, what would fellow members of Congress do? I suppose there may be some sort of rebuke, some sort of minor...
One member of the Congressional Black Caucus, Alan West, a Republican from Florida, has said he may leave that.
Well, he was the only, he's the only member, black member, the only member, Republican member of the Congressional Black Caucus anyway. So, and there wasn't one before he joined. So I guess that would not be a punishment in and of itself. But the fact of the matter is, even if he is sanctioned in some way, he represents a district where this probably doesn't hurt him as a, in practical terms. I mean, it's an overwhelmingly Democratic district.
You know what? As it's been redrawn, it's not as
it's
Democrat,
not, still,
and it's and it's
not,
not
as much.
And it's not as
it's still a Democrat district.
It still is.
But
it,
that's one of the reasons I think he gets away with the fact that he doesn't think he needs to apologize, because he's in a safe district.
Well, that's,
and he thinks
you
he
can say
survive.
That about any number of members of Congress who say things that they regret later because they're in districts where they view themselves
as
safe.
But they're not saying this kind of racist stuff.
Well,
I mean,
now wait a minute. When we're talking about racism, and you look at the portrayals by the Tea Party of the president, look at those visuals they use, Mike, and it is, you're burying your head in the sand if you don't think there are elements of that.
He basically said congressmen want to kill people, and he said that that is just absolutely wrong.
I have said, and he has said, he would use different imagery and different words, but that's not the same as backing down from the fundamental statement he was saying.
So you sanction it then.
Do you think at some point he will temper those remarks?
He's already begun to temper those remarks. But that doesn't, I don't think he backs away. But I think the imagery that he uses and the words that he uses to convey his feelings on this need to be tempered a little bit. But that doesn't mean he has to back away from what he's saying.
Time now for some viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question is, how would you describe Andre Carson's Tea Party comments? Your choices are A, accurate, B, outrageous, or C, unnecessary. Last week's question was, how would you describe Phil Hinkle's behavior? 33% chose sad, 5% said disappointing, 14% said hypocritical, 48% said all of the above. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Former Indianapolis Mayor Steve Goldsmith was recently arrested in Washington, D.C. According to the New York Post, Goldsmith spent 2 days in jail after an argument with his wife, Margaret, back in July. The Post cites police reports that say Goldsmith shoved Margaret into the kitchen counter and then refused to let her go. Police arrested Goldsmith. No charges were filed. Days later, Goldsmith quit his job as deputy mayor of New York City, saying he wanted to pursue opportunities in the private sector. Ann Delaney, did that arrest make his resignation mandatory?
Well, if you listen to the Bloomberg administration, that's what happened. I mean, he offered it, but they were quick to accept it. You know, I'm finishing my last day at the Julian Center after 15 years.
Which is a center for
domestic violence, and I've learned a lot about that issue during the course of those 15 years. And it's not at all, I mean, domestic violence doesn't just happen in certain neighborhoods. It happens in all kinds of families, including wealthy and educated families. And in addition to that, it is very common for the victim, usually the woman, to recant. That happens all the time, and it makes it difficult to make the charges. But, you know, having said all of that, the police did what they should have done. In those situations, domestic violence is a third of the murder rate in most metropolitan areas, and they have to take action, and they did. And I think Goldsmith did what he had to do to save the Bloomberg administration.
Well, in that case, the police officers didn't have a choice. I mean, there is,
in
that jurisdiction, it's mandatory, as it is in, I think, 22 states, that if they're called to the scene of purported domestic violence, somebody's going to go to jail, if only to serve as a cooling off period.
Exactly right, and it's a good law. one we don't have here.
I mean, this is a story that really rocked Indianapolis. I mean, here's a guy that he left office. There were a lot of questions about why he left office so suddenly. I mean, one of the questions is, how do you keep this quiet for a month?
Well, I mean, he was, first of all, I think it rocked Indianapolis because he was a good mayor. He did a lot to move this city forward. There's no question about that. But this was a shocking development. He did the right thing by quitting as mayor of New York. Only he, or deputy mayor of New York, only he and Margaret Goldsmith actually know what happened there. But the discrepancy between the police reports and what's being said now, you know, I mean, that's just
hard to
comprehend. So, yeah. But that's what people are struggling with, because this doesn't fit the image of the guy that the people of Indianapolis knew, and that's what makes it so shocking.
What does this mean for his political future?
Well, I'm not sure that this... You could say that it shuts the door on a political future, but I'm not sure, as a practical matter, what kind of interest he had long-term anyway. If you look at his tenure as deputy mayor in charge of operations for the city of New York, long before this incident arose, he had already had any number of problems. He had butted heads with the unions. He had offended some of his own fellow administration members. He was seen as not
poor having response to a snowstorm.
To a snowstorm, where he, I guess, was spent a good chunk of that actually in Washington, as opposed to in New York. So
I mean, that's one problem here, is that it points up that his primary residence is still in Washington, D.C., and Mayor Bloomberg had promised the voters in New York that he would move to New York.
And I don't think that this alone causes long-term problems for him. I'll tell you who it does cause significant problems for, and that's Michael Bloomberg. And if you look at the real anger, I think, on the part of many New Yorkers and members of his, well, I was going to say his own party. He's not either party, I guess, officially. But there are people who have been supportive of Michael Bloomberg in the past, in the council, elsewhere, who say, you know, he really botched this and that there was a lack of transparency.
Well, what they're saying is that he should have revealed the reason that Goldsmith left.
Well, not only that,
he should have revealed the arrest, shouldn't he?
That's absolutely what they should have done. I think that the fact that it comes a month later and was dug out by the New York Post is really what casts the biggest question on all of this and makes me really have a hard time squaring what they say now with what the police report says. Look, if it happened, it's an unfortunate situation, and it's going to lead to the resignation. It should have been revealed immediately, and that's why they have the big problem that they have now.
And Bloomberg, we should point out, not only did he not reveal it before, but when this did break, he actually went into hiding effectively, canceled a lot of his public appearances. His press staff was saying, no comment, no comment. And I think it's that what's seen as stonewalling or cover-up, if you will, is seen as a real...
It was a stonewall.
Well, yeah, I guess that is, meets the definition.
Reality TV star Rupert Bonham says he wants to see if there's enough support for him to be the next governor of Indiana. Rupert, who lives in Indianapolis, competed on the TV show Survivor. This week, he formed an exploratory committee looking to run as a libertarian.
Are we ready to elect one of us and try and show Indiana how to be a little more understanding and self-sufficient at the same time?
John Katzenberger, is there any reality connected to that?
Boy, I sure hope so, Jim, because we got a gridiron dinner on February 22nd. And this would be wonderful for that. So I sure hope that he goes to the post. And I was disappointed that he didn't even have a tie-dye tie or something.
He did have a tie-dye tie. He explained, actually, what one of the more impressive things about that news conference is that he had no opening statement except to say that he was wearing a handmade tie that was tie-dyed by his
wife.
There you
go. So I can't wait for February 22nd, Jay.
Oh, my. I mean, you say you want to run for governor, and then you call a news conference and you offer nothing. That's a bad start.
Right? Normally, you would come forward if you are the upstart. If you're coming from entering the political scene for the first
time, it's a bad start.
With a stronger message. I'm not going to say it was a bad start because he got a lot of attention, and I guess he's accomplishing what he wanted to in terms of getting his name out there and this notion that he wants to be taken seriously as a gubernatorial candidate. The problem is he won't be taken seriously as a gubernatorial candidate if he doesn't have a little firmer grasp of what he wants, where he would want to take the state, other than just saying make the state more self-sufficient.
I got to tell you that I think that maybe Mike McDaniel and I are two of the lesser surprised people this week, because Rupert was in the State House one day during the General Assembly and told us that he was working on this.
So you two are advising him then, huh?
We're his cabinet.
Yeah.
So you tell me he's out to a bad start.
What are the odds, do you think, that there's a reality TV show connected to the campaign?
That's kind of what I'm worried about in all of this. I mean, you know, I hope that's not the case. But look, the guy said he's thinking about it. And I think it's going to be difficult when he finds out how big, and Ann will tell you because she's done it. Running statewide for office in Indiana is hard. To be out there 18 hours a day, 6-7 days a week, to do what you got to do to get elected is very difficult, let alone raise the millions of dollars you got to raise. So thinking about it and coming to the reality of doing it are two different things. And if he brings some good ideas, if he does stick to it and they get him his petition signatures, he brings some good ideas to the race, more power to him. But, you know, there's a long hill to climb here.
If Rupert Bonham is the face of the Libertarian Party in Indiana, does that elevate or diminish their status?
Is that to me?
Yes.
I'd pass it to John. John, what do you think?
I'll say this. It does boost the visibility.
It boosts not the visibility. Does it elevate
your
status?
If you subscribe to the theory, there's no such thing as bad publicity, I guess it's a home run. Yeah. But
that was well done.
Does it increase their chances of getting more than 2% in the next election?
No. He seems like a nice man, and he's done some good things with his life. But you've got to come forth as a serious candidate. This is a serious job, and there's a lot of things to do here, and you just can't say, okay, I've got a tie on, and therefore I'm ready to go because I know how to be self-sufficient. You've got to be out there with ideas, and you've got to propose them in good faith in order to have the kind of following that would take even to qualify for the ballot.
Actually, the Libertarian Party already has automatic ballot access, right? So he would
right,
have to
have a convention. If anybody else chooses to run, he has to win it.
But the convention isn't until April,
which right. we get back to. That's well after February 22nd. I'm just trying to set John up for one more plus.
That's right. So that gives him seven months to come up with an idea,
which is after February 22nd.
The state of Indiana is preparing to pay the maximum compensation to the victims of the State Fair stage collapse. That's $5 million. It has also created a remembrance fund for private donations. Now, a victim's compensation expert is being brought in to help divide up that money. His name is Ken Feinberg. He's a well-known lawyer who allocated money to victims and families after 9/11 and after the BP oil spill. John Schwannis, is that a good plan?
Oh, I think absolutely. Clearly, this tragedy, the best thing is to say it never happened. Short of that, it did happen. We did have the deaths. We did have the injuries. You got to say this is about as good as it gets in terms of response. The state's willingness to step forward, perhaps to, you know, there's probably an altruistic motive and also a practical motive, which is if people accept these dollars, then I guess they would waive their claims against the state. So there wouldn't be extended litigation that could drag on and cost the state more money in the long run, not beyond the cap, but just to deal with the litigation. And also it helps. It's the right thing to do. It gets money in the hands of people who need it.
Well, but is it the right thing to do? State Representative Ed Delaney says he's going to file a bill because he says the $5 million cap in this case is too low.
If you look at it, Jim, there were seven people who were unfortunately killed in this situation. If they get the maximum, which is $700,000 per incident, that would leave $100,000 left for all of the rest of the people who were injured in this case. I think Representative Delaney makes a good point. He cited a precedent in Minnesota when the bridge collapsed near Minneapolis, where the state raised its cap from $1 million to $38 million. I don't know what the level should be, but clearly there needs to be more money from the state to cover these costs, because in this case, unfortunately, the cap is too low.
But this does
but there are going to be there are going to be quickly. Other people other, you know,
there could be other defendants, there could be other people responsible. But you get to the issue then too, that no matter what else happened there in terms of the stage and the inspection and all the rest of that, if the event had been cleared, if people had been called off and they were told to evacuate, nothing would have happened. So John's right. You need more money for this. You can't, as a state, operate a state fair and invite 12,000 people into that state fair and then not evacuate them properly and not, they may have inspected the stage, but they're not conforming to code because the code doesn't apply to the state property, and do all of those things and then just say, now here's what we've got for you, divide it up and go home. It's not realistic.
But the initial response from Senator Luke Kinley, for one, to that proposal is not good.
Well, first of all, you almost sound like you've decided where liability is to go here, and that's with the state. Nobody's determined that yet. There are studies going on of the evidence involved, and that's going to take a while. The idea that we ought to have more money involved in this, that'll be an interesting debate for this legislature. But I don't see them doing anything until all of these various forms of litigation have gone through the process, because there's no way you can, as John said, there's no way to know what the amount is until you've done that. And that's not going to happen between now and March or April when the legislature is supposed to end. It's just not going to happen that quickly. So at the best, in my opinion, you're looking at the next session of the legislature before you really do it and make it work. I'm sorry, Ann, but that's the reality of this thing. You can't just set a dollar amount out there and know what that dollar amount's going to be. It may be considerably more than what you set it at, maybe considerably less than what you set it at.
That's right, but you can set it at an amount that, given the number dead and the number injured, is fair. You can do that.
I just don't think this legislature is going to do
that. Well, you know, if they don't, then shame on them.
Well, then
because
that's your
an experience.
Opinion.
It is. But when you invite the 12,000 people to a state facility, you have a responsibility.
But you're deciding responsibility.
I'm not saying that there wouldn't be, that there couldn't be other people who are culpable.
But on the other hand, Greg Zeller's already said that
the $5 million is out
there. And Zeller, by the way, did a great thing in getting Feinberg involved because of his experience with 9/11.
But he's already conceded the $5 million, Mike.
And they have, yes.
Okay, but we haven't had that determination of liability that you're talking about.
They're going to give money to people that got hurt because they need that help.
Even if they're not liable.
Yeah. Well, they're going to give money to people that got hurt.
What's the difference?
Because they can't set the amount. How do you know if it's $32 million like they gave away in Minnesota?
How do you know it's five?
Well, you don't know any of it yet.
All right.
But you're doing it.
Moving on. The State Board of Education agreed this week with all of the recommendations made by State School Superintendent Tony Bennett. 4 Indianapolis schools and 1 Gary school will be taken over by the state. 2 other Indianapolis schools will see limited intervention. IPS Superintendent Eugene White has already threatened a lawsuit and at the board meeting objected to an agenda that allowed him to speak for just 5 minutes. Bennett cut him off.
You know, again, with all due respect, Ian, I think part of the problem we've had here is that we've waited to the last minute every step of the way, and it's been a negotiation every step of the way.
No, we didn't.
So I'll leave it to the will of the board.
And Delaney, can those schools be turned around if IPS and the state fail to cooperate?
Well, we don't even know whether those schools can be turned around by the entities to whom they're committing those schools, nor do we know what turned around is, since we don't have the standards established for what a, quote, turnaround is going to be. So to say that this is a moving mosaic is ridiculous, because you can define victory however you want going into that. And meanwhile, one of the big firms they brought in here, for-profit firms, has a terrible track rate in other states. So there you have it.
In the meantime, you have to be troubled by the contention between IPS and state government.
Well, yes. I mean, you would think that all of these folks want to do what's best for the students. And they had 6 years. This law was passed in 1999. And when it was passed, the 6-year threshold was a compromise with the Indiana State Teachers Association, because nobody ever thought that it would take 6 years to turn the school around.
Right.
Well, they didn't get it done. And so now somebody's got to do something to turn them around, and I applaud Bennett and company for doing it.
Does this get worse before it gets better in terms of relationships?
Yeah, I think it's inevitable. I think the stage is set for a lot of rocky road here. And I think the threat of litigation on the part of IPS, I mean, the board, as you pointed out, Jim, has already voted 4-3 to proceed with that litigation. And I don't doubt that that will occur, and that will only lead to further ill will, it seems.
Do they get over it at some point?
Do who get over it?
IPS and the state.
No, it's going to be contentious all the way to the end. And the unfortunate thing is you've got a lot of students who are affected by this directly, and they are pawns in this battle.
Finally, the city of Indianapolis imploded a vacant high-rise this week. The Keystone Towers were an eyesore and a haven for criminal activity.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, fire in the hole!
Mike McDaniel, what's better, fireworks or a good implosion?
A good implosion. This is a great video by Channel 8. I want to thank you for graphically showing what Obama's approval rating looks like.
Oh, oh my.
Actually, what they're showing is that they have a helicopter.
I'm guessing, I'm going to go out on a limb, I'm guessing there's a good chance that video is going to show up at the Gridiron Dinner on February 22nd.
February 22nd.
In that context, much like
Rupert. Right? Maybe Rupert's gubernatorial campaign.
Well, that could be too. Yeah. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike McDaniel, John Schwanes of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/podcast, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity. Just go to Hoosier TV and look for Indiana Week in Review under News. I'm Jim Shello of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Things can go wrong in 1,000 different ways. Businesses need a law firm that knows the 1,000 and first. The team of legal professionals at Ice Miller is committed to helping put the pieces back together. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.